international financial markets and instruments. We can understand the structure and architecture of the international financial system with this table here. So what we've got is this. On the left-hand side, we've got the money markets and the banking markets. On the right-hand side, we've got the capital markets, the securities markets, and the derivatives markets and other forms of alternative investment market, currency market, gold market, insurance markets, and commodity markets. I think this is very useful to understand the nature of all of the key markets and how all of this fits together. What we'll also see is this. We can build in the relative value of all of these markets by adding in all the monetary detail, by all the figures. And then what we've actually done is this. This was updated last year or the year before. If anybody wants to help update it again, we can do that. But we can understand the whole of the international financial system with just this one table. So what we've got is this. We've got the primary money markets, and the money markets, and the secondary money markets. The money markets are professional wholesale markets for up to 1 year. These are between wholesale participants, duration of only 1 year. If they're more than that, it's the banking market. The money market's a specific aspect, part of the subsection within the larger money markets. We'll come back and we'll look at all of this in more detail with the primary money market, the secondary money market, and then we've also got the gilt markets, or the international aspect of this, where we lend at the euro-dollar level. What we can also then see on the capital market side is that we've basically got securities and investments, securities and stock markets and exchanges, essentially debt, then equity. A lot of people think equity is the main thing on a stock market. It's not. There's more debt on all stock markets than anything else because governments and companies have to borrow before they issue shares. And they'd rather issue debt than shares. It's a complete misnomer. In practice, companies don't like shareholders. And companies do not like shareholders. They restrict your golden hello when you arrive, your bonus payments each year when you're there, and your golden handshake when you leave. Shareholders can cause a lot of trouble. People don't like shareholders. They like bondholders. And the difference between a shareholder and a bondholder is a shareholder actually has an interest, an ownership interest, in the total value of the company as a going concern. A shareholder owns a part of the company, a proportionate part of the company is a proportionate interest in the company as a whole. A bondholder doesn't. A bondholder only holds a debt obligation against the company. The company has to pay. A shareholder receives dividend. A bondholder receives interest. Shareholders and bondholders both have rights to information. They have some voting rights, but they're much more limited in relation to bondholders. And bondholders have much less voting rights and much less voting control over the activities of the company. All companies like bondholders. Virtually all companies don't like shareholders. Most debt on most companies are bonds. And banks specifically, what they would much rather issue always is bonds. So they have very large packets of bonds on their balance sheets rather than shareholders. And then we'll see this as becomes relevant when we look at capital adequacy, and we can come on and refer to that further detail. So we've got debt, equity markets. We've also got warrants and hybrids. A warrant is an entitlement to the same bond or share that you can exercise to receive more of the same. Depository receipts are something that represents a share. So for example, very often if you can't trade in American debt in America, what you can do is you can deposit it outside America and then you can trade it there in the form of a depository receipt. There's a whole series of a huge depository receipt market, and there's large institutions, custodians that hold these depository receipts. And very often, if you can't trade in the direct security itself, you can trade in the depository receipt, which effectively creates a direct, an indirect, or a surrogate market for those. We've then also got the Eurodollar market, basically a bond market, a note market, a commercial paper market, and then structured finance markets. Essentially, the Eurodollar market is made up of three key markets. There's the loan market and the bond market, but below that, there's a deposit market. And this is how the Eurodollar system actually evolved after the Second World War. The large American banks brought dollars from America to London, and then they started lending it to other banks in London. So it was basically a deposit market, a lending market between the banks. It was an internal interbank market to the Eurodollar system. So below the Eurodollar is an interbank market where the banks lend euro dollars between themselves. Originally American dollars, but now virtually every other currency in the world. On top of that, we then build the loan market and the bond market. One is loan direct contract, direct debt based. The other is security based. We've then got the shorter duration instruments now, with the notes, then the commercial paper, and now we've also built in the financial derivatives. And as well as in the securitization markets, we have the secondary securitization, which then creates the structured finance we've mentioned already. You can securitize assets by moving them from the banking side, from this side of the table, to that side through securitization. But then when they're on that side and they're securities, you can secondary or re-securitize to create what we call structured finance. And then there's three levels of structured finance, with the basic CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, CDO squareds, where we collateralize the collateralized debt obligations, and then CDO cubed, where we collateralize the CDO squareds. And we can come back and look at all of this in further detail. So we'll then see the derivatives markets, principally swaps, futures and options, as well as credit derivatives and hybrids. The main credit derivatives are called TRSs, CSSs and CDSs, total return swaps, credit spread swaps, credit default swaps. All of this is in your introduction document. And then we have the alternative investment markets. These are high income, high growth, high return markets, although they tend to be more specialist for more professional investors or groups of investors. We have hedge funds, private equity, sovereign wealth funds. We then have the currency markets. We can have the spot market, where we buy and sell currency today. And a very large important part of the market is then the forward market, where we buy and sell currencies in the future. How much money goes around the world every day? Over $6 trillion. And 65% of that is in London. 65% of that's in London, or a $6 trillion market goes around the world every day in the foreign exchange markets. The gold market, again, is based in London, at RM Rothschild's in Newport, just beside the Bank of England. The total gold market in the world is worth about $11 trillion, all the gold in the world. You've then also got the insurance markets. You've got the life markets and the non-life. The life markets are things to do with death. What's the two constants in the world? Taxes and death. So anything to do with life insurance, life cover, pension cover, anything like that is life insurance. Every other type of insurance is accidental or some form of injury insurance, so we call that non-life. Basically, the way the insurance markets work is that you pay premia, either initial one premium or multiple premium, which becomes premia, to get cover. What happens is the insurance companies receive those funds and then they invest it back into the markets. So who are the largest investors in the world? The insurance companies and other asset companies like that. So they basically take all this premia, about $2 trillion a year, then that is back invested back into either the bond market or the equity market, or all of these other markets. That's how the system works. That's the cycle of investment that we're going to be looking at. And then we have commodity markets as well. So this is the structure of all of the core markets that we're going to be looking at and that we're going to understand. Now, what else are we going to do? I've given you an introduction to the whole of the international financial system. So history of banking and finance, banking, international finance, international trade and merchant finance, merchant banking, investment banking, everything is on the system. International financial system, considering that in terms of main areas of instability and crisis over time. So we had the gold standard, the collapse of the gold standard, with the Bretton Woods system, we have the euro dollar system and the debt crisis, the 1970s and 1980s. We had the Asian and Russian crisis, 1997, 1998, and then with the credit crisis, 2007, 2010. We can now build into this coronavirus crisis and then the new geopolitical crisis following the invasion of Ukraine by Russia on 22nd February 2022. International financial markets themselves. We've already mentioned a lot of this, but we'll come back and look at this in further detail. You've got the main markets, the money markets, the capital markets, the euro-dollar markets, and then the euro-bond and the secondary markets. We've then got the financial derivatives markets, currency markets, gold market, commodity and insurance. What I've also done is this financial assets. I've taken the markets and then looked at all of the instruments that are dealt with on the markets. So restructured it in terms of all of the assets which we deal with on these markets. I think this is very interesting. I haven't seen it done before. It's very useful. So what we do is this. We have roughly five asset classes in each of these headings. Coinage and currency, credit and payment, public debt, corporate securities, and risk and investment assets. And we basically build everything in. All of the 25 most important types of financial contracts in the world, we build into this. So we can understand the markets from the table. We can understand the markets from the discussion and explanation here. And then we can also understand it in terms of the actual products dealt with on each of these markets. On the system, I have a chapter one that looks at the historical development of the markets and a chapter two that looks at the structure and operation of the main markets as well. The paper then looks at international financial centres and the different activities that are carried on in each of these. So international banking, investment banking, international bonds, equities, foreign exchange, financial derivatives, asset management, gold bullion, insurance and marine services. And I summarise and outline all of this. I then deal in further detail with the nature of global investment banking and then global commercial banking. This is a key division, key distinction. A commercial bank, what people normally refer to as a bank, accepts deposits. It takes deposits from the public, it pools those and it on-lends them. That's what a bank does. That's a commercial bank. An investment bank, an investment banking, that's dealing in securities. Historically, it's an accident of American English because as a result of the stock market crash in America in 1929, we had the Glass-Steagall. It was Carter Glass and Henry S. Steagall, which Glass-Steagall was part of the Banking Act 1933. And what the Banking Act 1932 did was it separates commercial banking from securities business. You get a separation under the Glass-Steagall provisions of the Banking Act in America in response to the stock market collapse, which began in 1929. So we have this separation, and the separation model is then copied in other countries, and we'll come back and look at that in further detail. As a result of that separation, some of the biggest commercial banks in America had to break themselves up. So J.P. Morgan breaks up and becomes J.P. Morgan, the bank, separately, and then I think it was H.S. Morgan goes off with Harold, goes off and forms a separate bank, commercial bank. Then you've got the division between the investment banks and the separate banks. So what happened was, I think it was J.P. Morgan and Harold Stanley goes off and forms Morgan Stanley as a result of the implementation of these systems. So what happened was this. We then get the beginning of this division between the commercial banking market and the investment or securities markets. Now, an investment bank technically is not a bank. It cannot take deposits from the public and lend. What are the large five most important investment banks in the world? Goldman Sachs. Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, it was Lehman Brothers with the bottom, it was these large institutions in America, these are investment banks, these are securities firms. Lehman Brothers was number four, and then Bear Stearns was number five. So it was Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns. Those were the five largest securities firms on Wall Street. Everybody calls them investment banks, and everybody talks about investment banking, but anybody in the market, including all the bankers, including all the lawyers, know they're not banks. It's an accident of American English. These are securities houses. They cannot do commercial banking business. What actually happened after the global financial crisis, J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley had to re-register their holding companies as securities holding companies to be bank holding companies so they could borrow from the Federal Reserve. Because a bank can't, a securities firm can't borrow from the Federal Reserve. Only a bank can. So these holding companies had to turn themselves into banks so they could borrow to save themselves as part of the global financial crisis. So we have a commercial bank and we have an investment bank. An investment bank is not a bank. It's a securities house. It's a securities firm. Although it's called an investment bank, it's not a bank because it can't do core banking business. There is something in the middle called a merchant bank. So we have commercial banks, merchant banks, and investment banks. A merchant bank is an old traditional English bank which emerged out of the early trade finance practices and then the beginning of the early securities markets as they grew and evolved in the 18 and 1900s. So these old-fashioned British merchant banks essentially could do both. They had commercial banking facilities for their larger clients, while they also provided trade finance, basically cross-border lending, foreign exchange, letters of credit, forfeiting any of these type of trade finance activities, as well as the new emerging securities activities, issuance, underwriting, anything like that. So the merchant bank was an anomalous hybrid type of commercial and investment bank. But most modern banks are either commercial or investment. But an investment bank's not a bank, it's a securities house. And where were most of the scandals, most of the problems that caused the global financial crisis? They weren't in the commercial bank area, they were in the investment area. Because that's where the abuses were. What actually happened was a lot of the large commercial banks had to then come in as white knights and rescue a lot of the investment firms that got into difficulty. JP Morgan specifically, as well as Bank of America and some of the other very large American commercial banks. So we have to be very careful about this. Commercial banks are banking traditional business. Investment banks are actually securities firms, securities houses. They're not banks, although we had this residual area of merchant bank in the middle, which could do both, an old traditional type of English-British bank. Now, what I've done in the document, I explain all of this, as well as the names of every one of the major institutions you can think of, including all the large Europeans, the four largest firms in Japan, all of them, they're all in the paper. So I look at the nature of global investment banking, I look at the different activities involved, equity and debt underwriting, market making and trading, asset management, advisory services, trade finance, foreign exchange, prime brokerage, other activities. A prime broker is a bank that provides services for a hedge fund. What do hedge funds need? They need basically lending, collateral, custodian facilities, they need dealings arrangements, and they need what's called stop lending. So what happens is this: if you're a large asset holder like an insurance company or a hedge fund, you don't just hold lots of shares. You want to lend them back into the market because by lending them, you get an income from the rental that's created. Now, why would people lend into the market and why would other funds borrow from the market? It's very simple. Short selling. Short selling is when you buy or sell something forward because you think the price is either going to go up or down. And if you're short selling the market, trying to force the market to collapse, you buy today with a view to selling later because you think the market's going to collapse, right? On the major markets, it's illegal to do naked short selling. And a naked short sell means that you don't own the security that you're selling. Now, a lot of the profitable business in short selling is being a naked short seller. You buy and sell something you're going to buy later because you think it's either going to go up or go down, usually go down in value. You sell it today at 100 because you think you can then buy it for 70 next Friday. You see? So you've made 30% profit on 5 days. You see? It can be very profitable. The problem is on the large markets, you can't naked short sell. So what you do is you stop lend. You sell it, then you borrow it from another firm, you pay a small rental fee for the 5 days, and then you settle the transaction next Friday, and you made 30% profit less 1% for the rental, for the cost of the short sale. So this is very important. Prime brokerage firms make a lot of money and they support these very large hedge funds. And I'll give you a separate chapter on hedge funds if you're interested. Lehman Brothers was the largest prime brokerage firm in the world. So when America, the American authorities, closed down Lehman after the Lehman weekend of 13, 14, 15 September 2008, that caused massive problems around the hedge fund industry. Not because the hedge funds had done anything inappropriate or anything that would be regarded as, you know, immoral or illegal or questionable in any way. It was simply that because they were prime brokers and had prime brokerage facilities provided by Lehman Brothers, which had been closed by the American authorities, after they had inconsistently helped JP Morgan Chase purchase Bear Stearns 6 months earlier with a $30 billion loan, and this is all in the papers. Because of that inconsistent treatment, what had happened was many of the largest hedge funds in the world couldn't get their assets. They couldn't get the cash and they couldn't get the securities because they were locked up in the insolvency of Lehman. Because Lehman was the largest prime brokerage firm in the world. So I explained the background to all of this, all the major institutions, how they all grew and evolved and took over each other. A lot of this is mergers and acquisitions. It's small firms taking over other firms, merging with other firms. I explained the background to all of this in the text. So we look at that in terms of investment banking, then commercial banking, and then the international financial markets we're going to come on to look at in further detail. So euro loans, euro bonds, project finance, securitization, and financial derivatives. Now, all of this is dealt with in further detail in the separate chapters, papers I provide on each of these subjects, as well as you've got a study pack which explains the background to the course of study itself, how we can divide this down into various sections. We have core objectives, we have core reading, additional reading, and then supplemental reading. All of this is explained. You get an index to the core part of the course that we're looking at in any particular stage, and then we go on to the next section. And each one of these has learning objectives, pre-class learning, post-class learning, as well as assigned reading, and then supplemental and additional optional reading as well. All of that is provided. On the system, I've given you a separate welcome statement. These are embedded audios, which means that they're kept in a Word format instead of a PDF, because you open them, you just click the button, and it talks. Okay? It's an embedded audio. In terms of classwork, you will be provided with everything on the system. All we encourage you to do is become familiar with the new language, this new script that you're going to be developing in the financial area. There's a lot of new words that you're going to have to learn, but it's not that difficult. And everybody does it, and everybody gets on top of it. So I will give you, and I'll show you this in a couple of minutes, a list of a lot of the best websites in the world to become familiar with, and then also a number of the key, most useful dictionaries and other electronic resources. If you come across a term, you don't understand it, yield, current yield curve, just use one of these. Have it loaded on your computer or on your phone. Just press a button and you've got everything explained immediately. Spend a little bit of time on this. You will get on top of it very, very quickly. I also encourage you to spend a bit of time on the financial press. The Financial Times is the best newspaper in the world. I would personally not be seen with any other newspaper ever. And then The Economist magazine. There's a very good finance section in The Economist magazine once a week, usually between pages 70 to 80, 80 to 90. It's usually about there. Very good. A lot of the most important, interesting things which have happened that week will be in The Economist. And it's just the best discussion you'll see with the Financial Times. On your system, on your electronic databases, electronic access systems, you have all of this is available. You have access to all of this. I personally have it on my phone. I just press a button and it opens immediately. You have access to all of this. You have it all for free. There's also various other very useful core materials. For example, Palgrave. There's a Palgrave Dictionary of Money and Finance and a Palgrave... There's one on economics and one on money and finance. These are very good indeed. They're three volumes, excellent resources. But the problem now is simply because of the power of modern social media, you can virtually find everything on the internet anyway. The Palgraves are excellent. I have both sets, six volumes in my room, which I use when I'm writing more heavy type stuff. Dissertations, exam technique, course revision and review. I will give you materials on everything. I'll give you materials, recommendations, how to write an excellent dissertation, and then again, how to prepare for an exam, how to write an exam, how to come up, structure the best exam questions to get the most possible highest marks that you can. We will give you everything that you need. This is online study. There's a separate introductory section I have on the paper about what I call digital online learning, DOL, digital online study, DOL, DOS. digital online teaching, DOT. It's much easier now to learn, understand, simply because of the power and availability of information and the access that you have. And everything else that you need will be made available on the system for you. These are the key websites I was referring to earlier. I would become familiar with all of these, and then we can also update this building, anything else which is useful on the site. So this is the websites, and then these are the electronic dictionaries. So these are just some of the things you can use. Some of them have changed a little. This is all on the system. You have it all available, and you just press the button. They're all HTML linked, so just touch it. It'll take you there immediately, or just copy and paste it into the box at the top. So all of that's there. Find one or two that you really like, get familiar with them, and use them to begin with until you settle. The best simple one I would say is Investopedia. It's excellent. All the core stuff you need is in there. So anything you might want, CDOs, CBOs, CLOs, anything you might think of, you might want to spend some time on, just follow up on this. The key is knowing where everything is and having this available very quickly when you need it. And it's very easy to do now in current times, simply because of the power of modern social media and electronic online systems. I also encourage you to think about study groups if you are interested. You could even form a study group by yourself if you want, but that's not the purpose. If you want to work with colleagues, what you can simply do is this: discuss things, allocate work, and then come back and report, spend some time discussing things together, preferably in coffee shops, coffee houses. So I've given you a list of questions for the finance type issues, areas, and then another set of questions for regulation, and I'll also build in new financial technology, regulated technology, artificial intelligence. The key point simply is this: it's to go back to the beginning. Think about things in a structural manner where you're looking at all of the key terms. Where are the core definitions and how does all this build up? So it creates a sort of logical, structured representation of what you're doing. This can be useful. All you simply do is you could do it yourself, just working through the materials that you've got, understanding where it all fits together, or you can do it in groups with your friends, just to get involved and just to become, make it a bit more interactive and a bit more enjoyable that way. But you have everything you need for that on the system as well. A lot of the basic stuff is also in the key slides, and we'll come on and look at the core slides which are provided as well as part of all of this. The key documents, as I've said already, are the introduction document on the left hand side. You've also got a separate parallel paper on the euro dollar markets, a separate parallel paper on the City of London, and also the introductory slides which summarise all of this again. And then another set of slides on London coffee houses and the City of London, so that you can understand all of this. I've separately provided my chapter one is historical examination of all of the markets, how it all evolved and developed. And then chapter two is a structural study of all of the key modern markets as well. You have everything you need online.